I'm an alcoholic, and my name is Dottie Shore. Hi.
Hi.
Thanks so very much for having me up here. You know you have a beautiful country up here, don't you? You have a lot of rain, too, and you can keep the rain, as far as I'm concerned, but it is beautiful. Have they got a fire over there, or what is it? You see the fire? Is it a fire? I hope not. At any rate, how many of you here tonight have been at a retreat before? Raise your hands for me. Most of you have. Well, let me tell you what I think I can help you with so that you can get the full enjoyment out of this retreat. I've been very privileged to lead a lot of retreats, and I've kind of gone it by, trial and error till I found out what for me has been the best. Now, first we're going to look at the word retreat. Retreat means to fall back, walk away from, change your course of action. It also means a retreat when you blow a retreat in the services. It means it's time to go to bed, it's time to retire. So if you'll think about the word retreat, and retreat for these next few days, we'll be here together, away from everything. Above all, as men, please retreat from your job. Please leave your job down the hill down there. Also retreat from your families and your finances and your home and your lawns and your cars, and just pull back, kick back, and try not to think about these things if you can help it. They'll flip through your mind. Don't do a lot of forcing, but when they come, just say to yourself, it's not time to think about this now, I'll think about something else. You can make it a fun retreat, or you can make it an escape. You can sleep all the time you're here. You can do a lot of praying and meditating, which I hope you'll do. So many people say to me, how do you know when God talks to you? How do you know, you ask for God's will, how do you know? Well, most of the time we don't shut up long enough to listen to Him. And if you can kind of pull back and just listen to the still small voice of God, let Him speak to you. Now, when you're walking, and I hope you'll take some walks, and I hope you'll enjoy this outdoors, if you see somebody walking, if they don't acknowledge you, don't speak to them. Leave them alone, because so many times we'll be walking and maybe meditating or just looking at nature, and someone will come up and we'll start to talk about mundane things, and you've lost what was there. Now, I don't mean to have walk around and be silent and be in a deep meditative mood. I don't mean that. But give yourself some time while you're up here to do that. Now, tomorrow, when I imagine everyone will be here, you don't have to do anything I suggest. Please know that. I have some pieces of paper, and I'm going to break the group up in half. And one half of you will write your name on a piece of paper. The other half will draw names, and you'll be paired as a buddy with one other person, hoping that it'll be someone you don't know very well. And between now and tomorrow night, when we share, please give yourself and this friend or buddy 1 hour to share experience, strength, and hope. And then tomorrow night we'll try and share what you learned from that person. Because when we get to the place where we can't learn, we're in a sad state. To be teachable is the most wonderful thing we can do in AA. And many times you come up here with a friend and you kind of drift in with a friend. Please go home from this retreat knowing somebody a little bit better than you did when you got here. You'll find it to be a really rewarding experience. Our program says we seek through prayer and meditation to improve your conscious contact with God. And like I said, if you don't know how to meditate, let me tell you. You simply go out and sit or walk, and don't try to make your mind a blank, because if you do, 1,000 thoughts are going to go through. Nature abhors a vacuum. When the thoughts start to race, let them race. Just let them go. Just let them tumble one over the other, and take big, deep breaths and walk and look, and pretty soon your mind will quiet down. And maybe not then will you hear the still small voice of God, but during the retreat sometime, you will be made conscious of something you never knew before. Don't seek for it. Don't strain for it. Just follow a few simple rules and see what happens. And it'll be a beautiful retreat for you. Please remember, we are on a retreat. So retreat from all your problems. Retreat from your babies that you're working with that you're afraid are going to be drunk by the time you get home. Your children, your wives, your job, your money, all these things. Just retreat. Leave them down there. You can pick them up again Sunday night when you go home. But if you'll do this, I'm sure that you'll say to yourself, That was one of the greatest weekends I've ever had. Just to pull away and be with your higher power and a real good friend before you go home. Now, what I'd like to do now is to share my experience, strength, and hope with you and let you know who I am. Some of you know me, some of you don't. But I'd like to have you know a little bit more about me so you'll understand that I'm just exactly like you. I may be a female, but I am truly an alcoholic. And I've been to hell and back. And these 12 steps have saved my life and my sanity. And I'd like to share with you, if some of you don't know, one of the greatest events of my whole life took place yesterday. At 11 o'clock yesterday morning, I celebrated 30 years of continuous sobriety. I think that's kind of nice, don't you? Did you all see my 30? Isn't that pretty? 8 girls that are dear close friends of mine got together and gave a party, and 8 girls gave me this for my birthday. And last night I blew out 30 candles at North Hollywood in one quick sweep. Can you imagine me having enough air to blow out 30 of them? And it was really nice. But I think because my birthday is close, and every time I have a birthday, I usually take a pretty good inventory. Because I have to find out how far I've come in this past year. I've got to find out some of the good that I've done, and I've got to also see some of the defects that I have not been able to get rid of, or those that I've gotten rid of that hop back on me again. Take an inventory of myself, and I'm very pleased to tell you that I'm an awful lot better than I was last year. So it means I'm progressing. I'm certainly not perfect, but I'm better than I was last year, and that helps. I will tell you that my alcoholism lasted about 19 years. I was a periodic alcoholic for many years. I never drank without getting drunk. I never drank alcohol as a beverage. I hated the taste and the smell, but man, I loved what it did for me. And so on any occasion that I could, I drank and got drunk. It wasn't until 4.5 years before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous that I stepped across the real heavy line and became a chronic alcoholic. And I drank the clock around. I was never drunk and I was never sober. I was just not there most of the time. I was born and raised in Reno. I had 2 sisters. Both of them are alcoholic. My mother and father were heavy drinkers, although not alcoholic. Much alcoholism in my family. My mother and father's brothers and sisters, there was much alcoholism there. And I was raised during the prohibition times when it was the thing to do, you know, like the kids today are on their funny little cigarettes and their dope. And to us in those days, it was really quite a thing to make the bootleg whiskey and go out after a dance or in between dances and take this rot gut down. And I hated it then. I hated the taste of it. And I used to pretend like I was drinking. I put my tongue in the bottle and tip it up and shiver and go through what everybody else did. But I never touched it until it became very boring to be around with a lot of drunks and me be sober. So I finally taught myself how to drink. My oldest sister was 2 years older than I am, and she was a radio singer, junior champion skier, and a model. And she was adored by my mother. My mother really lived her life through this sister. Then when I was 9 years old, I had a baby sister come along. And somewhere along the line, I got lost. And I don't remember any trauma in my life when I've taken inventory until the time my baby sister was born. And I became an unpaid babysitter. My mother had her in her menopausal years and didn't like the fact she had another child. And so I was more of a mother at 9 than I was a young girl. And I don't remember ever having a teenage life. I look at some of the teenagers today and I don't know what they're going through because I never had a teenage life. I was grown up when I was 9 years old. My life went on very unhappy, and watching my sister be dressed like a princess. I would go to school with cardboard in my shoes because mother had put all her money in on my sister because she sang. And I began to feel very inferior. I've always been a talker. I fell in love with my voice at an early age, and the love affair is still going on. And I used to chatter all the time. My mother used to say, "For God's sake, shut up." And she put her hands over her ears, and I couldn't shut up. So I rendered myself incapable of being understood. And I stammered and stuttered until even the teachers couldn't understand me. Now, as I grew a little bit older, the stammering and stuttering let up a little bit, but it was still pretty pronounced. And I started going with a boy when I was 14 years old, and he was 17. Now, don't forget, when I was 14 years old, I was a grown woman. We didn't have any teenage at that time. And fell madly in love with him. And the depression was on, and he had to leave Reno and come to California to live with his mother. His grandparents had raised him. And when he left, the bottom dropped out of my life. It was just another sense of rejection that I was to know. And so he came to California, to Los Angeles, and I was still living in Reno. And within a very short time, we stopped writing. He stopped writing to me. And I started going with another boy. And this other boy was a very romantic kid and loved to dance, and I loved to dance. And we went double dating with another couple. And this other couple decided they were going to run away and get married. And this kid said to me, "Why don't we make it a foursome?" And I said, "Fine." And so when I was 16 years old, I ran away and married this young boy. And I found out he didn't even have a job. But my whole idea to get married was to get out from this impossible situation with my sisters and my mother. And so, of course, it was very bad. I didn't get away because he didn't have a job, and we went back home and lived with my mother. 2 months later, I was pregnant for my oldest daughter, and he hated the fact he was going to be a father. And I can see now why. He was only 17. He said she'd be more like a sister or a brother to him than a child. And so I made my first big vow that I was going to have this baby. He wanted me to have an abortion, and I was totally knocked out for that. And so I made up my first vow that I was going to have that child, and she wasn't going to belong to him. It wasn't going to belong to my mother or my sister. I guess I thought immaculate conception had finally come back, because it was going to be all mine. And I can tell you, looking back on it, and I have 20/20 vision hindsight, that those 9 months I carried that baby was the happiest I'd known up to that time, because I felt for the first time in my life that I was worthwhile. Well, now that child was no longer born, and I was just praying to God that she'd grow up and get out of my hair. I was terrorized and afraid of her. And I was still living at my mother's. And like I said, this boy that I was married to wouldn't hold the baby, wanted nothing to do with her. And so instead of going home to mother, I just kicked him out. And in the meantime, this first boy I told you about, the one I went with when I was 14, he was 17, his name was Al, came back to Reno. And the moment I saw him, I knew I was in love with him yet. And he had nothing to do with the first separation, but very shortly after that, he and I got together, and we got married. Now, he adopted my oldest girl. She was not quite 2 years old, and had always been a good father to her. And I was born and raised Roman Catholic, and if there's Roman Catholics here now, I'm not talking against the Roman Catholic Church. I'm talking about an alcoholic priest that I was raised by. And this man terrorized me. And my grandfather built the Roman Catholic Church and almost all the schools and the courthouse in Reno, old, you know, homesteaded in Reno. So everybody knew us, and we had a lot of priests and nuns in our house at many times. And so when I was wheeling the baby outside one day, the priest was walking up and down, reading his office, and he came over to me and he said, "When are you going to have your baby baptized?" And I said, "Not till I get married again." And you don't tell a Catholic priest that, but I did. And he drew himself up and he said, "You can't get married again. If you do, you'll be living in adultery, and each child of that issue will be illegitimate." And I said to him, "I don't care, I'm going to get married." And he said to me, "You're excommunicated." Well, dear friends, if God had said, "You're excommunicated," see, it couldn't have been any more for me, because the priest was God. And so I walked away from the church. My mother didn't realize that the priest couldn't excommunicate me. And so I walked away from the church, and for the next 19 years, I wandered the face of this earth like a lost soul. I was sure I was going to burn in hell forever. When Al and I got married, within 5 months after our marriage, I was pregnant for our daughter. And as my luck would be, she was a very sick child. And for the next 7 years, we never expected her to live. Now, I wonder if you know how many times I buried that child in my mind. Every time she was sick, God was going to kill her and punish me. Because, after all, I had been excommunicated from the Roman Catholic Church. And I went to 1,000 funerals. I picked out 1,000 little pink caskets, 1,000 little pieces of gold shoes. I would go in my mind and close her door, let the dust collect on her toys. I really milked this neurotic, morbid imagination. But it was almost to set me crazy. And as I was telling the guys on the way up today, I thank God for alcohol. Because I firmly believe tonight that if alcohol had not come into my life and numbed this feeling, I would have gone straight to the top of my head. I think they would have locked me up for the insane. Like I said, for 7 years, many nights I never undressed. My husband and I would take turns. He would sit with our daughter for 4 hours, and I'd sleep, and I'd sit with her for 4 hours, and he'd sleep. And we found out later, and knowing now, that she had high allergies. And in those days, there was no antibiotics, no antihistamines, and she would go into bronchial pneumonia. And she had a gallbladder that was defective, that it wouldn't function. And so we'd be scared that she was going to strangle, and we'd have to pull strings and mucus out of her throat. And this went on for 7 years. and it almost drove me insane. I drank periodically at this time. I was a good mother to that child, but I never drank without getting drunk. And then came along the time when we were married 10 years, and my husband's grandmother, who had raised him, came to California, and she was dying of cancer. And so he left on our 10th wedding anniversary and came to California. Now, to me, again, that was the ultimate rejection. And I, thinking about it now, it makes me sad to think that I didn't realize he had to come, that his beloved grandmother had sacrificed a great deal. But see, all I could think about was the hell with the grandmother. How come he can leave me? And so, as most cancer cases, her cancer went into remission. And he called and asked me if we could come to California and live. And, of course, I had nothing to say with it. So I had to give up my home and go to live with my mother until such time as he could get enough money to send for us. Now, when I went back to live with my mother, it was a fate worse than death for me, because I had to put my furniture and everything in storage. And my mother, to the day she died, was a hopeless neurotic. They were heavy drinkers. She was not an alcoholic, but heavy drinkers. And she would scream and yell about the kids. The girls were slamming the door and come in and peel the potatoes and set the table, and it was yak, yak, yak the whole time. Now, during this time, my oldest sister was married, and we used to go over to her house in the afternoon before we went grocery shopping, and that was my mother's idea of a big day, to go grocery shopping every afternoon, put on her gloves, her hat, and her clothes, and go grocery shopping. But before we went grocery shopping, we'd go to my older sister's, and we'd always have a highball. And this was a common occurrence. But I can look back on the day that the highball meant more to me than it had ever meant before in any other part of my life. We went to my sister's to have the highball, and that when that drink set, it seemed like all of a sudden I no longer cared about anything. I didn't care about anything anymore. And I went to the liquor store, to the grocery store that day, and my mother, poor mother, she would tell the whole story of my life as she went through the checkout stand, that my husband had left me, that we didn't have enough money, that the kids were driving her crazy, and I'd go through this day after day till I couldn't stand it any longer. And so one day, I said to her, "Mother, you go ahead and get the groceries. I'm going to the liquor store and pick up some cigarettes. I'll be right back." And I stood in there waiting for the cigarettes and looked on the shelf, and I saw the alcohol, the booze up there. And I told the man I'd have a half a pint of whatever it was, and I put it in my purse. And that was to be the first of 1,000 bottles that was to come into my purse for the next 4.5 years. And from that day to the day I called Alcoholics Anonymous, I never drew a sober breath. Now, I wasn't a falling down drunk, you understand that, but I was never sober either. I went home that afternoon and went upstairs to my bedroom and hid my first bottle. I can remember it was yesterday. There was an umbrella hanging in the cupboard, and I opened it up, put the whiskey in the umbrella, and wrapped it up and hung it back up on the shelf. Now, when I came downstairs, my mother would be yakking and screaming, and I'd run back upstairs and have another drink. And when I'd come downstairs, she'd still be yakking, but I didn't hear her. Her mouth was going, but I didn't hear her. Booze just went, and it turned her off. And so I was to be with my mother and with these children and my husband down here in California for a long time. And when I knew I was drinking too much and I knew I was getting in trouble, my thought was, yeah, but when I get to California and we're a family again, I won't have to drink. Anybody ever identify with that? You know, if I just do this or go there, I won't have to do that. And so finally the time came when my husband's grandmother died, left him a small inheritance, and he sent for us. Now, I don't know how many of you are familiar with the San Fernando Valley, but there's a place down there called Pacoima, and I thought it was pronounced Pacoima. I couldn't even pronounce it right. I went to Pacoima to live. Well, now Pacoima, after living in Reno, you can imagine, was a very small and very desolate place to live, and my drinking accelerated. And, of course, I had the greatest reason in the world not to drink. I'm away from my beloved mother. I used to write to her every day and call her twice a week on the telephone. And yet I couldn't wait to get away from her. Well, this alcoholism went on for quite some time. And during the Christmas holidays of 1949 and 1950, we decided to go home to Reno for the holidays. We got in our car and went home. When I got home, my mother had been writing to me about my sister Evelyn. And I thought, thank God she's pounding on her now instead of me. Because she was saying that Evelyn was drinking and Evelyn was doing this, and Evelyn was always her beloved, and I was the one she pounded on. So I thought, well, now that I'm away from Reno, she's just after my sister. But when I got home, I was so shocked at what I saw that I couldn't believe it. Now, I told you she was a radio singer, junior champion skier, and a model, a beautiful girl, and she had developed cirrhosis of the liver. Her stomach had swelled the size of a 9-month pregnancy. She was wearing dirty blue jeans and a maternity jacket and wandering the streets of Reno like a bum. This was the talented girl, and I was totally shocked. And I said to my brother-in-law at that time, isn't there something you can do? He said, we've tried everything. We've hospitalized her, taken her to a psychiatrist. He said, if you don't think I've tried everything, I even called a bunch of people that call themselves Alcoholics Anonymous, and they say they can't help her unless she wants help. It's the only sum total of anything I've ever heard about AA, and of course I didn't identify it for me. It was my sister. And I remember during that Christmas, I hurled the words at her, you've become a dirty alcoholic, haven't you? Little knowing that I was a full-blown alcoholic at the time myself. But see, alcoholic was a dirty word. And so on the way home from that Christmas, my husband said to me, my God, I hope you never get to be like your sister. And I can remember saying, don't be silly. I'm much too intelligent to let a thing like that happen to me. But the seed had been planted. And so I thought, well, it was just before the holiday, New Year's of 1950. And I thought, well, I'll go on my last bender on New Year's Eve, and then the 1st of January I'll stop drinking. So I got drunk that New Year's, and it was a bad one. And the next morning I couldn't get out of bed. And it was the only time that my husband brought me a drink to bed. And I was about as sick as I've ever been. Now, in all the time I've been drinking chronically, I had never, ever attempted to quit. I had never suffered a hangover. I had drank the clock around. I would get up in the morning, I would take 4 or 5 straight shots and vomit them all up till one would sit. And then I'd do well. I could get my kids off to school and do my housework. They say alcoholics don't have any willpower. It takes willpower to take 4 or 5 shots and vomit them all back up before one sits down. But during the month of January of 1950, I was to go through more hell than I've ever gone in my life because hallucinations and blackouts set up. Now, I didn't know what a blackout was. When I got to AA, they told me I was in blackouts, and I thought I was just terribly preoccupied. You know, I was thinking very heavy, and all these hours had gone by, and I don't remember where I was. And I had blackouts, and I had hallucinations. I thought I had people up with their eyes like this looking in the window. And so I'd pull the window shades down and take a drink and walk around, pull them all back up. I was the TARDIS drunk, I think, that got to AA. I had foam coming out of the hardwood floors. I knew it wasn't there, but I would fan at it and see it like dry ice and water bubbling through the hardwood floors. I was absolutely terrorized. I wouldn't go out of the house. I was afraid to go out and even empty the trash, because one time I went out and invited some people to dinner. Don't ever remember it. When they came to dinner, of course, I wasn't prepared, so I convinced them it was the next night. And I had to stay pretty well sober to give them dinner the next night, so I never went outside. I sent my children to the grocery store. I never ventured out unless I was with my husband. And I'm sure you all know that I'm an extrovert, but I became totally introverted. I confined myself to a prison, the 4 walls of an apartment. I was my own prisoner, and it was horrible. This thing went on until I almost went crazy. I would get through almost every afternoon till 3 o'clock. And then the terrors would set in, and then I'd have a drink. So I never made a day in January of 1950 without drinking. As the thing went on, I finally decided I would have to do something about this. So there was one afternoon, one day that I got up and did all my work, and I was doing a wash. And at that time, I had a little service porch, and it was a wringer-type washing machine. And I started to clean my house, and I went back to see if the wash was done. And when I took the lid off the washing machine, it was a grocery basket. It was half-filled with groceries. I was fully dressed. I was walking down the aisle of a grocery market. And I screamed. I was absolutely terrorized. I did not know what had happened. And I ran out of the store, went next door, and got a bottle. Isn't that what we always do when we're terribly scared? And I went home and I uncorked the bottle and I took a drink, went in the other room and sat down, looked around, my housework was done, my laundry had been hung up, my makeup was on. I don't remember anything from the time I started the wash about 10 o'clock that morning, and it was about 3 o'clock that afternoon. I went out in the kitchen to have what I thought was going to be my second drink. The bottle was almost empty. Another couple of hours had gone by and I was totally terrorized. I was also afraid of my girls coming home and finding me too drunk. So I started down the hall to find out what time it was. It was 1 o'clock we had, was in the bedroom. And as I stepped into the hall, I bounced off all 4 walls. I'm sure you've seen when the space deal was going on, how you get into weightlessness and they bounce all over the place. I did that long before the astronauts did. Bounced off all four walls. And I remember screaming, "My God, help me!" And it was echoing, "Help me, help me, help me, help me." So I must have had the screaming meanings, I don't know. My next recollection that I can tell you about was someone saying, "North Hollywood AA Clubhouse." Now, dear friends, I don't remember that I looked it up in the phone book or called the operator. I have no way of knowing what happened, except that I came out of this thing with someone saying AA Clubhouse. And I said, "How do you know if you're an alcoholic?" And the person on the other end of the line said, "Is it for you or your husband?" And I said, "It's for my husband, of course." And then I started to blubber and cry, as only an alcoholic can blubber and cry. And this woman said, "Don't kid me, it's for you, isn't it?" And I said, "Yes." She said, "I'll come right over." And I said, "Oh God, you can't do that. I don't want my husband to know I'm an alcoholic." And she told me later she thought she had a drunk and a ding-a-ling at the same time on the phone. But she said, "Okay, I'll come out tomorrow on one condition, that you're not drinking. Because if you drink, I'm leaving. I want to talk to you and not the bottle." Marvelous bit of advice, believe me. So when my husband came home that afternoon, I told him, I said, "I'm 1 week from now, I'm going to have a big surprise for you." I don't know what they thought they were going to do, give me a shot or do something with me. And I told my kids, I said, "1 week from tonight, I'm going to have a big surprise for you." I thought in a week's time, this alcoholism would be taken care of. So the next day, I got up and got the kids to school, and I didn't drink. God, I sweat and shook and died, and got those kids off to school, and the woman came, who was to be my sponsor, about 9 o'clock. And she walked in, and she said, "Well, how much booze do you drink?" And I told her, and she said, "I spilled more than that." And I thought, gee, she doesn't understand anything about how I'm dying, you know. But she began to describe to me and explain to me that this was a disease, that I was not just a no-good mother, a weak person, but that I had a disease called alcoholism. And I remember thinking to myself, boy, they really got a cop-out. You know, if I tell people I'm sick, they can't get mad at me anymore. So she talked to me for several hours, and she wanted me to go to a meeting, and I said, "I can't. I've got to find a way to get away from my husband." Now, I didn't know anybody in California. And she told me this statement that I was to remember a long time. She said, "Honey, this is an honest program. You start lying and you're not going to make it. You've got to tell him." So I said, "Well, let me do it my own way and I'll go tomorrow night." So when he came home that night, I said, "I've got something very important to tell you." And he sat down and I made him sit in a chair with his back to me. And I said, "I'm an alcoholic and I called Alcoholics Anonymous." And his shoulders started going like that. And I said, "Oh, dear God, please don't laugh at me." And he turned around and looked up at me with these tears streaming out of his face, and he said, "I'm not laughing." He said, "I had the papers all ready for Camarillo State Hospital for you." I was that close to being sent away. And God knows, in my terror and in my insanity, had he locked me up in Camarillo State Hospital, I would have freaked out. There'd have been no return for Dottie Shore. So I was to start my path in AA. I went to my first meeting on February the 8th, 1950. That's 31 years ago. Of course, I was only 9 years old at the time. You understand that? Well, this is an honest program. I was really 10. And so the very first meeting, I was so scared. I was just terrorized. I thought I was going to see a lot of drunken people like my sister Evelyn, you know, with dirty blue jeans and all that. And I saw people just like you. I couldn't believe that I was actually in a meeting that was going to do something to help me. And that night, they had the birthday cake celebration. Same night that I went last night on Thursday night. And I saw those people get up there and get their cakes, and I saw people pat them on the back and tell them how wonderful they were. And my little mind says, gee, I'd sit in audiences for years and watch my sister Evelyn get a bouquet of roses for, you know, for singing, or get a cup for skiing, or just model. And I thought, all I gotta do is not drink for a year. And I'll be up on that stage and all you guys will be down there looking up at me and I'll have my night on the stage. And that's what I really thought. Now, the only thing that was just upset me is when the leader, the speaker spoke, and he was a man that had a real heavy alcoholic career. He talked about fifths a day, sanitariums, jails, 502s, 86s. My God, he scared me half to death. And I thought to myself, you know, maybe I'm not an alcoholic after all. Maybe I scared myself into this thing. Maybe I'm only a little alcoholic. Well, you know, you can't be a little alcoholic. You can't be a little pregnant. You know, you got it, you got it. But the trap I fell into, friends, is to try to identify with a drinking pattern. Now, all you guys in here probably can't identify with my drinking pattern, but that doesn't make me less of an alcoholic than you, or it doesn't stop me from identifying with you. I do ask you while we're on this retreat to identify with my thinking pattern. The drinking pattern will be different, there's no doubt about that. But see, it's the stinking thinking that leads to our drinking. And I can sit down and talk to any of you, and I talked to Mike here. I didn't know Mike till I got here. And in 5 minutes, Mike and I understand each other, and Bob and I understand each other, and the rest of us will too, because we're alcoholic. It makes no difference if you're male, female, young, or old. The disease of alcoholism is identically the same. Alcoholism is only a symptom of a deeper-seated problem, and we all have the same deeper-seated problem. We follow such a pattern. We're perfectionists. We're procrastinators. We're liars. We're highly emotional, easily upset, and very sensitive. Anybody identify with me tonight on this one? I'd say so. So at any rate, I tried to identify with the drinking pattern instead of the thinking pattern. But I left there that night so enthralled with you people. I weighed 82 pounds. I was suffering from malnutrition. My lips were split and bleeding at the corner. I drank constantly and never ate. I was totally terrorized. I couldn't buy a dress by myself, arrange my hair by myself. I couldn't make the simplest decision whether to put a coat or a sweater on my kids. If I put a coat on them and it turned warm during the day and they had to carry that coat home, I was sure everybody in the whole neighborhood knew I was dummy. I wouldn't hang a wash unless my husband could assure me it wasn't going to rain. Because if it rained on my wash, everybody knew how dumb I was. Now, I never knew then what I know now. I know that I was totally egocentric. An inferiority complex is ego turned in. And I simply walked in a house of mirrors and a ball of self. It was what everybody was thinking about me. I never thought about anybody else. And it was very difficult for me. Now, when I walked through the doors of North Hollywood, not one person said to me, "My God, put some weight on. How much money do you have? What kind of a car do you drive? Tone your makeup down." They said, "You got an alcoholic problem?" I said, "Yeah." They said, "Then you're in the right place." And they put their warm arms around me, and they totally accepted me as I was for the first time in my life. Dear God, not as I could be, would be, or should be, but as I was that night. I'm sure you know what that is, don't you? Never any time in my life did anybody ever say, "Hey, you know you're okay," until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I find that most any place I go now in AA. And this is a strange, strange gift we have in here, friends. It's called agape love. It's spelled A-G-A-P-E. Now, agape love is God's kind of love. It's unconditional love. And that's what we find in Alcoholics Anonymous. Where else would you imagine we could go and have a total men's retreat in one gal? I think it's wonderful. Love it. I love it. I had to laugh last night when I was accepting my cake at North Hollywood. I told them that I was coming up here to lead a retreat for all men. And I said, "You know, it's supposed to be a spiritual retreat, but if I don't get a pass made at me, I'm going to just blow my brains out." And some guy came up and gave me a big hug, and he said, "If they don't make a pass at you up there, they ain't got any class." But it's been so much fun, and I've been really thrilled to pieces about this. So at any rate, I loved the people there. I loved everything about them. And I had this idea in my mind that 1 year from that night, on February the 8th, 1951, I would be up there to get my cake. And so looking back on it, 20/20 vision hindsight, I went dry for a year. Now, like I said, I have a gift of gab, and there was very few women who would speak in 1950, and so they found out I could talk, and they put me on the circuit. I was a circuit speaker when I was 49 days without alcohol. Can't you imagine what that was like, man? I'm glad they didn't tape it that night. I'd probably get drunk listening to it. And so I spoke from Bakersfield to San Diego, any place in between. I went back to work 3 months after I was sober, and I had 2 daughters and a husband, an apartment, full-time job, and spoke practically every night. I was in 365 meetings that first year. I had more AA babies at North Hollywood than anybody else had. I absolutely jumped on cloud 199. I was the happiest thing that ever came across the pike. Now, I didn't know that the AA book tells me that you and I are used to 3 things. Excitement, anxiety, and depression. Peace of mind and a quiet heart. You and I don't know anything about that. So I went into a state of excitement upon an excitement plane for quite some time. Loved every bit of this. Went to meetings, poured coffee, greeted people. Just thoroughly loved it. My weight came back on. My kids quieted down. My husband enjoyed going to meetings with me, and I just thought that I had finally arrived. I'd made it. Well, the year went by on the wings. On February 8th, 1951, I stood at the podium at North Hollywood. And man, I had a corsage stuck out about that big. I had rehearsed my acceptance speech for 6 months. It was wonderful. You should have heard it. They started telling me how wonderful I was, and I agreed with them. It was really great. I can look back now and tell you that I would tell everybody, the people I'd worked with that never had a drink, bragged about all of them, never told anybody about the people I worked with that had gotten drunk again. I didn't even know them. I remember during this year, looking back, that was a girl that I was her sponsor, and she kept getting drunk all the time. She'd call the North Hollywood Clubhouse and tell people I was her sponsor. So I got in the car and went over and threatened to beat the hell out of her if she ever drank again, because I wasn't going to have any failures. At least if she's going to drink, don't tell anybody I was her sponsor. It was really sad. Now, during this time, I had a photographic memory, which is a God-given gift, and my sponsor was a bookwoman, and she would quote the book up one side and down the other. So I'd run home, memorize pages of the book. I can quote you the book practically from cover to cover tonight. And so I talked it, and I preached it, and I read it, and I recited it, and I memorized it. I did everything with it but work it. And I got news for you. If you don't work the program, you will fail. The program you can't get by osmosis, just sitting there sucking it in. And I thought I could. I believe we're split personalities, and you don't have to agree with anything I say. But I think we're egocentric with inferiority complexes. Anybody agree with me? This side of your personality, you say, I'm so dumb, I'm stupid, God, if anybody's going to get fired, or the rumor goes around, it's going to be me. But this side says, God, we're so gorgeous. We give such a talk, best sponsor in the world. And the old pendulum swings like this, so it throws us totally off balance. Well, when I got here, my personality was stuck on the inferiority side. And it swung to the middle. If it had stayed someplace in here, I'd have been all right. But it hit the egocentric side of my personality, and I really believed that I was the best thing that ever happened to AA. Now, I'm going to share with you something, and I hope you listen if you hear nothing else I say this week. Ego will get you drunk faster than the next drink. Did you know that? Ego is edging God out. E-G-O. And if you start to believe that you did anything about your sobriety, that you're here because you're so smart, or so rich, or so talented, and I tell you, you won't have time. Thanks, dear. You won't have time to stay sober. Because I fully believe, had I had any idea that I was doing something wrong, that I wasn't working this program, I would have been shocked. I could tell you the 12 steps. I've never taken inventory, because that's not for me. It's for you sick dinglings, you understand. You're the alcoholic. I've just been around so long, and I'm such a good speaker. I'm here to help you now. I don't need it for myself. And I didn't know this was going on. I really didn't. I thought I was doing a wonderful job. So after this first birthday, when I had gotten this cake and I got so many pats on the back and so many presents, I guess I thought I'd graduated. And I'm tired. So I thought, well, I've got a year of sobriety. I'm an old timer now. I'll sit back and let the other people take over. And I broke my meeting pattern. And I started going on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Well, if Tuesday night came and there was a good television program on, or it was raining, or it was too hot or too cold or whatever, I didn't go. Now all of a sudden I'm thinking to myself, God, it's been a long time since my sponsor called me. Well, the hell with her. I won't call her either. You can get very lonely doing things like that. I started complaining. I was full of resentments. I'd go back on a Tuesday night, having not been there since the following week. Nobody rushed to the door to ask me where I'd been. And I'm resentful. And my sponsor tells me at this time, she said, you better do something about your resentments. I said, I don't have any resentments. I have justifiable anger. Don't give me that word. And so I started pulling back. And my husband told me, I started saying things like, I might as well be drunk as the way I am. Those SBs over there don't appreciate me. They've taken me and squeezed me dry like a lemon, and they've thrown me away. Who needs them? And I'm in actually what I call now a dry drunk. How many of you know what a dry drunk is? You do the same identical thing without alcohol as you do when you're drinking. And there's so many symptoms that you can see. I have some tapes over here, by the way, and I have a full tape on the syndrome of the dry drunk. And it would be very advisable to listen to it, because not too long ago, after 30 years of sobriety, I went through a dry drunk. And it's hard for us to recognize. I was doing and thinking the same way, super critical, bored, gossip. Fell into a pattern I hadn't been in years. I didn't know it until some dear one that I love said, "Hey, you're on a dry drunk, Dottie," and I thanked God for it, because you never know. See, we're the last ones to know. You can become so close to your own problem. So at any rate, I know that I was in a dry drunk for a long time. Well, the thing went on, and finally on June the 10th, 1951, I went to a beginner's meeting at North Hollywood. And I can remember it like it was yesterday, and the leader asked for the newcomers to raise their hand. About 15 people raised their hand, and he said, "You are the most important people in the room." I thought, like hell they are. You know, if you lose those newcomers, you've lost very little. But if you lose an old-timer like me now, you've lost something. And I'm angry. So I always like the meeting before the meeting and the meeting after the meeting, don't you? Oh, boy, I split out of there on the way home, and I was so angry. And I thought, you know, I'm going to fix them. I'm going to get drunk, and then they're going to be sorry. Did you ever get drunk at anybody? It hurts them terribly, you know. While you're on the floor dying, it really hurts them. So I went in a total fantasy, and I thought, well, let's see, now I knew I was going to get sick, because I had been sick for a long time. I drank and vomited a lot, or as the guy said, I unswallowed a lot. And so I thought, well, I'm not going to hide the bottle. I'll put it out on the coffee table, and I'll put my feet up there. And when my husband finds me drunk, if he doesn't like it, I'll tell him to go to hell. But, oh, I can see him go at the phone calling North Hollywood. And he's saying to the people over there, "My God, Dottie's drunk," and they're saying, "Oh, no." And then they get in a caravan of cars, and they come over and 12-step me. They come in the house, and they make amends to me, and I forgive them. And they pick me up in their warm arms, and take me back to North Hollywood, and I'm a newcomer again. Now, see, what I wanted is to be a newcomer. I wanted to have the pats on the back. I wanted them to treat me like I was a baby and to tell me how wonderful I was. And see, my sponsor was busy working with newcomers, and the other people thought, you know, well, she's sober now, and they were busy about their father's business, and instead of minding their business, and I was totally thrown off balance, and what I really wanted to be was a newcomer. Now, had they kept me there, patting me on the back and telling me how wonderful I was, I could have stayed with them for many years, very sick and dry. But when they withheld, and of course, feeling because I had such a gift of gab, I could talk this program. I could give them, you know, anything they wanted to know. They thought that I was solid. I can remember looking back and knowing that during this first year, any similarity between my story and what I told was purely coincidental. Every time somebody says something funny, it became part of my story. Oh, I had a magnificent pitch. You should have heard it. Everything funny, everything that was drastic, it all became part of me. You know, that's what they say why you and I as alcoholics are such good liars. We first convince ourselves it's the truth. Then we can put our hand on a stack of Bibles and swear to God it's the truth because we believe it. So at any rate, I made my plans. It's going to be just exactly like I planned it. And so on June the 11th, 1951, 30 years ago yesterday, I got up and I cleaned my house because I didn't want them calling me slob. I had everything all arranged. I put my makeup on and my earrings and even put clean underwear on in case something happens, you know. My mother used to say, "I have clean underwear on." And I went tripping to the liquor store, and I bought the same half pint that I had always drank. And I didn't drive because I knew about blackouts by that time, and I was afraid to drive. So I came home, and I uncorked the bottle, went out in the kitchen, poured myself the first drink. But first, let me tell you, when you're married to a non-alcoholic, and most of you are, boy, they sure can find bottles, can't they? They can find bottles better than we can hide them. And so my husband would find the bottle every now and then and pour it down the sink. About 2.5 years before I came into AA, I discovered one day that vinegar and bourbon were the same color. So I poured the vinegar out of the bottle and poured the whiskey in the vinegar bottle, and I drank out of a vinegar bottle for about 2.5 years. 3 days of being without alcohol, being sober. I know tonight it was just dry. But I went home, and I didn't care who knew I was going to drink, right? But I still poured the vinegar out of the vinegar bottle into the sink, poured my whiskey in the vinegar bottle, and took my first drink out of the vinegar bottle. Well, when the whiskey burned my throat, if someone had slapped me in the face and wakened me out of a sleepwalk, it couldn't have been more violent. Because that was the first conscious thought that I had taken a drink. I was mentally drunk long before I took that drink. And when it burned my throat and the realization came that I had drank, I remember saying, "My God, what did I do? There goes 16 months of sobriety shot to hell." And I had my hands on the door, and I stood there petrified, waiting for something to happen. Nothing happened. Hell, I knew all along it wasn't like those drunks over there. So I walked out in the kitchen to have what I thought was going to be my second drink. And what I tell you now was told to me by my husband and my sponsor. He was an outside salesman, and he knew I was squirreled up, so he decided to knock off the territory that morning and come home. And a half a block before he got to the house, he heard me screaming. And when he opened the door and came in, I was on the floor, kicking and beating my heels till I almost broke the bones. I had dry heaved till I broke a blood vessel into my esophagus, and I'm vomiting blood from my nose and my mouth. I broke the blood vessels in my eyes till there was no whites left because of this dry heaving. All the blood vessels in my eyes had hemorrhaged. And when he tried to get me up off the floor and put me on the couch, he said I went totally limp and he couldn't get any breath. So he tore out of the house. He had a car, but he just ran, knowing that there was a medical center a couple blocks from where we lived. And there were 7 doors along a sidewalk of medical doctor suites. And he came to the first one available. The office was full of people. He went past the receptionist into the doctor's examining room, grabbed the doctor by the arms and said, "You've got to come. My wife's been sober 16 months and she's drinking. I think she's dying." My dear friends, the first of many miracles was to set forth for me, because the doctor did not say, "Get the rescue squad. I've got an office full of people. Who recommended you? Fill out this form." You know what they do. He simply picked up his bag and ran the 2 blocks with my husband. And you know why? He was an alcoholic. Isn't that odd? That's God. When he got there, he put the stethoscope on my chest. He turned to my husband. He said, "All vital signs are gone. There's no heartbeat, no pulse, no respiration." So at 11 o'clock yesterday, 30 years ago, I was pronounced dead of a drug called alcohol. The sum amount I had that morning, friends, was 3 straight shots of booze. Now, you spilled more than that, haven't you? But you see, my higher power, whom I choose and love to call God, knew that I had to have it wiped out in one quick sweep. That is not how much you drink. It's not how long you drink. It's not what brand, whether you're periodic or chronic. But can you guarantee what's going to happen when you take your next drink? Well, see, I can today, because for me to drink is to die. I have no more drunks left. When my husband got hysterical when the doctor told him that I was gone, the doctor said, "I'll try one last thing." He took a needle about that long and he shot me directly in the chest cavity. He gave me artificial resuscitation, and by the grace of God, I started breathing. Now, let's take it back. If Al had been a minute late coming home, if the doctor had hesitated a couple of minutes to make the decision to come, they could have brought my heart back beating. But my brain would have been damaged beyond repair. When I woke up the next morning, I was sedated all night long. When I woke up the next morning and tried to open my eyes, I couldn't. They were swelled almost shut. My face was swelled. You talk about poisoned. I was poisoned. I am highly allergic to alcohol. And so my husband left the 2 girls in the next day, that next morning. He had kept them out of the bedroom until then. And here's 2 frightened kids standing at the foot of my bed. And my oldest daughter said, "Mother, we want you to do us a favor." And I said, "I'll do anything if you just won't be mad." Now, these girls had gone to AA with me. They saw me get my cake. The house had quieted down. Can you imagine the shock when they came home that afternoon and their dad had to say, "Your mother's drunk again"? And so I'm heartbroken seeing these girls. And my oldest daughter, I said, "I'll do anything, just don't be mad." She pulled the big A book out from behind her back, and those 2 kids stood at the foot of my bed and read me the preamble in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, many times we hear about a statement in the book that says we suffer from pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And that day was my pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. 2 girls standing there reading the 12 steps to me, and tears rolling down their face, with much more faith in the program than I'd ever had. They kissed me goodbye and went to school. Well, I had to start all over again. The hardest thing for me, egocentric Dottie, was to go back to North Hollywood and let anyone know that I had drank. And even then, even after almost dying, I'd made up my mind that I was going to bluff it through. I wasn't going to tell anybody I drank. Just going to go ahead and pretend like nothing happened. And I went to the meeting a couple days later and walked through that door. It was like I had a big sign saying "slip" going on and off like a neon sign. And I went to the doctor a couple days after this. He took me by the shoulders and he shook me and he said, "I want you to listen and I want you to hear me good." He said, "You are as dead as anybody I've ever examined, and if you drink again, you will die. Do you understand me?" And I said, "Yes." And the first thought that went through my mind is, why didn't he just let me go? geez, I had my out, you know, and life has been hard for me. I don't like today the way things go on out there. Do you? It's a rough world out there. I don't like it. If I didn't have AA, I don't know what I'd do. But I sure didn't like it then. But on top of that came the thought that there must be something that God wanted me to do. And I vowed that day, about the 13th of June, 30 years ago, that I would never be too tired nor too busy to answer a call for anyone. And do you know, dear friends, that's the easiest commitment I've ever made? And now, some 30 years later, I'm still going about my Father's business, loving every minute of it. Now, I know He left me for a reason, because I should have been dead 30 years ago. But I'm here, and I'm healthy, and I'm very happy with it. And so I've tried to find out what He wanted me to do. And my whole idea is to help the alcoholic who still suffers. And you know, I found that not to be the newcomer. Now, of course, I'll carry a message to a newcomer. But you know who I like to carry the message to more than anyone else? The alcoholic who still suffers. The sober, without alcohol, who's still suffering. I was to be 5 years sober and torn apart. I was to be 12 years sober and torn apart. Not drunk, talking, helping, but still my guts just churning. And I finally had to go for therapy, for psychiatric help, to find out that my background was really a very deprived childhood. And I made a vow then that if it would ever be possible, somehow, that I would like to make my life's work helping the alcoholic, the compulsive overeater, the drug addict, the migraine headache people, the ulcer patients, the high blood pressure, all these emotionally induced illnesses. It was to take me almost 12 more years after that before I finally was able to do as I'm doing now. I now am a private therapist. I have a private practice. It's the greatest joy of my life to be able to help people, to be asked to speak on retreats like this, to be asked to speak at conventions. I'm still in awe of it. And I still know tonight from the bottom of my heart that I can't take credit. That I am standing here tonight sober and sane by the grace of God. The grace of God means a free, unearned, unmerited, unwarranted gift. See, I didn't earn it. My last drunk was when I was laying on the floor, bleeding to death and dying. That's when I was granted the gift of sobriety, so I can't take credit for it anymore. And don't ever take credit. Because the AA book tells us that no human power can relieve alcoholism, but God can and will have sought. If you take credit for it, you're on dangerous ground. If you give the glory to God, you're always going to be all right. Last night there was 10 cakes given at North Hollywood, and only 2 of us thanked God. The rest of them thanked their mother and the plumber and the gardener and everybody else, but never thanked God. And I think it's sad. I think it's fine to thank the group and your sponsor. But I think above all else you should thank your higher power, because no human power can relieve this alcoholism. God could and would have sought. And that's true. See, I have 30 years by the grace of God, and I would love to take part of my sobriety and go give it little bits of it to the newcomer. But you can't give it away. You can't steal it. You can't buy it. You can't sell it. Where does it come from? It's a free, unearned, unmerited, unwarranted gift from your higher power, whatever you choose to call him. And so the life seems to go on. I wish I could tell you that since the time I got to AA, everything's been wonderful. I've just jumped on the bandwagon and sailed off in the sunset. And I hear old-timers say that, and it makes me kind of nauseated, if you want to know the truth. Because that's not life. Jesus said, in this world there will be trials and tribulations. Even He didn't promise us it would be easy. We keep our eyes on the Lord, we can do these things. And so, if you come in here and say, oh my God, I've been sober a year, where's all the goodies? You know? Gee, I've done this, I've been out making all those talks, how come I don't have the breaks? Well, you may and you may not. Now, as far as getting younger, I'm 30 years older. I look younger tonight, by the way, than I did 30 years ago. That's a miracle of God. The first thing that went down in my life is I was to be sober 3 years when this beautiful, talented sister that I love so much was to blow apart with cirrhosis of the liver and die a very agonizing death of alcoholism. And if you think alcoholism is a pretty death, I got news for you. It is not. Her head has swelled the size of both of her shoulders. Her stomach swelled out there like she's pregnant. I had to go home to Reno to a drunken Irish wake. My mother got so drunk that night she fell off the chair. My whole family gets drunk and my sister's dead of alcoholism. And I'm sober trying to hang on by the skin of my teeth. When I went home and looked in the casket and I saw my sister, who was almost unrecognizable to me, I thought, you know, the script is wrong. Dumb Dottie should be in there and Evelyn, the talented one, should be up here making all these arrangements. I didn't understand what was going on. And through my mind went a statement the AA book says, we cease to fight everything and everybody, including alcohol. And the very last words my sister was to say on this physical plane as she came out of an anesthetic where they tried to tie off all these blood vessels, she looked up at my brother-in-law and she said, Bill, I want a drink. The very last words she was to say on this physical plane. So she kept on fighting and she died. I simply threw in the towel, surrendered, and I won. Came back to California, making it through that god-awful wake. And a couple, 3 or 4 years later, my oldest daughter became a full-blown addict, alcoholic. And she's smashing her life away. And she's got a little boy. The little boy is being badly neglected. And I'm torn apart, not knowing what to do. And finally, my sponsor, who was an AA, and my attorney and everybody said, Dottie, you're going to have to take that kid away. You're contributing to the delinquency of a minor child. His toenails had grown to the top of his toes. His heels were split and bleeding because of neglect. And it was heartbreaking to me. I didn't know what to do, but finally I realized that's what I had to do. And so I had to kidnap that child and keep him out of sight for about 48 hours because she could have had me arrested for kidnapping until we could get the guardianship paper signed. The morning that the process server served her with the papers, he said she was so stoned she couldn't see the paper. And she signed the paper, and then when he left, she simply walked out of her apartment with the clothes she had on and disappeared off the face of this earth to all intents and purposes. It's a hard thing, friends, to go through. I was heartbroken. I didn't know if I'd made a mistake or what. We searched everywhere. Nowhere was she to be found. Her apartment was left clothes, furniture, everything. There wasn't anything for me to do except to pick up the pieces and try and help my grandson. And I did. I spoon-fed him this little pieces of AA. He quit sucking his thumb and wetting the bed, and he started to get a little well. I seemed to do pretty well for about 8 months. And then I started waking up about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning with a smothering sensation. Like I couldn't get my breath, like a pillow was over my face. And so I went to the doctor. I thought maybe it was my heart or my lungs. And he examined me and said there was nothing physically wrong with me, but that it was an emotional thing and I better go to a psychiatrist. On the way home, I'm crying and I'm thinking, what in God's name's wrong with me? I've been in AA all this time. I'm then 15 years sober. What am I going to do? And I was working with a girl whose husband was an Episcopal priest. His name was Father Ken, great member of Al-Anon and a wonderful guy, very understanding. And so I found myself on my way over to see him. And I said to him, Father Ken, what do you think's wrong with me? He said, Donnie, you sound like you're in a panic. What are you panicked about? And then I really started to cry. And I said, I'm afraid I'll never see Ann alive again. He said, Dottie, you're going to have to accept the fact you'll never see her alive again. And I said, but I can't. And he said those words, then keep on fighting. How many times God has let me have those words? And I remember to cease to fight everything and everybody, including alcohol. And the only fight I ever gave up was booze. So I went home that afternoon. I got down on my knees and I said something along these lines. All right, Lord, I don't understand how this can be your will. But if it's your will that I never see Anna alive again, I surrender her to you, even unto death. Please, just give me the strength to go through it. It was like a load went off my shoulders. I finished the day out, went to bed that night, and for the first time in 8 months, I slept all night. I got up the next morning, got about my business, and at noon, the phone rang. It was my daughter. Isn't that odd? That's God. Now, she didn't get well right away, but it was like God letting me know that she was at least alive. Now, my daughter has been sober and clean 16 years. When she first got well and came home, I couldn't take her home because I had Greg. But at any rate, we started talking, and we talked about, one day we were talking on surrender, and I said, I surrendered twice at depth, once for alcohol and once for her. And she said to me, when was that, Mother? And I started telling her. As we checked back on it, the day that I got on my knees and surrendered her even unto death was the day she had gone into Tijuana, Mexico to pick up her drugs. Now, at that time, you could go through the cross into Mexico, go to any drugstore and pick up 1,000 of anything you wanted. No prescription needed, just go into the drugstore. But shortly before this, the Hells Angels had been picked up going across the border. So Tijuana closed down. She went in to get her drugs, and they didn't know what she was talking about. It's not like going to another liquor store. And she was burned out, and she was tired. Now, I weighed 82 pounds. I'm 5'2". My daughter's 5'7", and she weighed less than 70 pounds. You can imagine what she looked like. She looked like skin stretched across a cadaver. And so she came back into the San Fernando Valley. She'd lived there the whole time. And she blocked all the doors and windows. She took an overdose, her last of her alcohol, of her drugs, He's turned the gas on and laid down to die. And that afternoon they turned the gas out for lack of payment. Isn't that odd? It showed me one thing. I think many of you in this room, if you're like most alcoholics, have someone in your family that's breaking your heart, that you want so badly to help. Maybe it's a kid. Most of the kids are on drugs these days. Or it's a mother or a father or a husband or wife or brother or sister. And all I can tell you is that from my experience, get out of their way. Get out of the way and let God have them. See, I feel like here was Ann, here was me, and here was God. And as long as I was in between, he couldn't get through. But when I stepped over here and let them get together, it was just a matter of time. Because shortly after that, she was to call. It was after she had woke up and found out that she was still alive. It's when she called and asked for help, and I was to be able to get her other people to help. And she's been sober and clean 16 years. Next thing was to go down in my life is my husband went into business with an alcoholic partner, a practicing alcoholic. I begged him not to, but he wouldn't listen to me. We sold our house and took our savings, and we're less than 9 months. We're total bankruptcy. Lost our house, our savings. Came out of the bankruptcy court with $7 and an old car. And we were not young people, and we'd worked a long time. Well, thank God I had you people, and I had 12 steps, and I had a program, and I had God of my understanding, but my husband didn't. I went back to work. They told me I could only sleep in one bed, eat one meal, wear one dress, and I knew it was true. But my ex-husband became a compulsive worker and a compulsive sleeper. And he got to the place where he runs like seven devils are after him. He doesn't walk. He worked 15, 16 hours a day. He would come home, eat, fall asleep on the couch, not undress. Night after night, not go to bed. Day after day, not take a shower. I lived with him for another 8 years like this. And I couldn't stand it any longer, and I loved him too long to hate him, so I had to leave, and so I was divorced. Well, that's a rough thing to go through. And during the time I was getting the divorce, I knew I couldn't take care of my grandson. But I had to go out and get a job and take care of myself, so my daughter was well by this time, and I said, you take your son back. And he went back, and less than 6 months when he was with her, he ended up total addict alcoholic. I believe alcoholism and drug addiction are hereditary. You don't have to agree with me. And so, because we are in the program, his mother and I, he used about a year, and now he's one of the youngest members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he's got 7 years of continuous sobriety. So we have three generations. What's the purpose of all this story I'm telling you? The purpose is that it doesn't make any difference what happens to you, friends. It's how you react to it. Everything goes around, comes around. If you're about your father's business, doing the best you can, the statement that we have in every AA meeting, I'm sure you have it in signs in yours, is this too will pass. This too shall pass. Nothing lasts forever. Happiness doesn't last forever. Sadness doesn't last forever. But if you stay sober one day at a time in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't care what goes down, you can make it. And nothing is so bad that a drink won't make it worse. See, booze won't fix it anymore for you and I. Drugs won't fix it anymore. Those funny cigarettes won't do it anymore. The only thing that's going to do it is the program and ventilating and talking to another human being. One of the greatest things you'll have to watch out for if you've got anywhere from 2 years on is what I call seniority syndrome. It'll kill you. Twice in 30 years I've contemplated suicide. Never to drink. My mind is so programmed for me to drink is to die. I don't think I could swallow alcohol. I don't know. But there's many ways to kill yourself. And when I would get to the place where I couldn't tell people how upset the great Dottie Shore was, and the old ego came back in again, I would read the steps. I'd pray. I'd read the book. I was going to do it myself. And it would become so much for me that I would think, I've got to have a way out. Now, the last time this happened, and praise God, it will be the last time, I was standing in the pharmacy, and it was a dreary, rainy day, and I was waiting for a doctor to give me an okay on a prescription. And there was nobody behind the prescription counter but me, and all the bottles of barbiturates were in front of me. And I saw the Seconal up there, and I thought, gee, all I have to do is just take a handful of Seconal, put it in my uniform pocket, and go home and take it, go to sleep. Well, thank God it went through my mind. It didn't come in and stay there. And that night, as soon as I got off work, within the other half hour, I called my sponsor, who was then my sponsor, and I told her. We talked half the night. And she was the one that coined the word seniority syndrome for me. She said, Dottie, you're going to kill yourself one day. Who do you think you are that you'll ever be long enough on this program that you won't need help? Now, if you're in trouble, you ventilate. You tell people. For you people here, watch out for the old-timer. You know, what the hell an old-timer is, I don't know. A person who's been around the program. If you don't see him in the meetings, call him. If you see him at a meeting, talk to him. Don't ignore him. Because sometimes we who've been sober a long time need you so much more than the newcomer. You look at us and you think, oh, hell, they got it together. They know. Honey, we'll never all have it together. And when I'm upset now, I don't care who has to know. I'll scream. I've gone into meetings and I've said I'm upset, and I've had people say, well, my God, if you're upset as long as you've been sober, this program isn't going to work for me. And so I bottle up and I don't talk. Almost cost me life. I don't do that anymore. So if you're upset, talk. Pull some guy or gal aside and say, hey, I got to talk to you. And ventilate it. Get it out. Because it's very, very important that we will never, ever have this thing made. Our disease can only be arrested. You know that, don't you? We are one drink away from a drunk. We have a daily reprieve according to our spiritual status. And most importantly, we have no defense against the first drink. We suffer from a disease that's cunning, baffling, powerful, and patient. We only have a daily reprieve. Now, thank God I've got 30 years. It's the biggest miracle I ever thought would ever happen to me. But see, I could make or break it today. And as long as I stay in Alcoholics Anonymous, and as long as I'm an alcoholic and breathing, I need you all so much. I don't know if you know what you've done for me by inviting me to come up here and being willing to sit and listen to me, to think that I have something I can offer you, that maybe this world is a better place because Dottie Scholl was born instead of that big blob taking up space. I hope you'll know that I love you from the bottom of my heart, and that I am your servant this weekend. I am available. I will let you pick my brains. I will give you everything I've got. The only thing I ask from you is that you give me your love. Thank you very much.